So, logic programming languages. There are basically only three logic languages out there. There's very little research being done on logic languages now. The main dominant programming language for logic is Prolog, which we'll go into for most of the lecture today. So, a little bit about administration. The registration for in my campus is now open, so you can register for the exam. There are two options. Either you can do this lecture together with the history of programming languages as a module, a bigger module for as a module. Then email Prof. Snyder. Otherwise, email Prof. Philipson for getting a time and date. Right? That's it. So what is a logic? When do we call something a logic? First, we need to have facts, and we need to have rules, and we should be able to infer new facts from previous rules. If you have those things together, then we have a logic. On top of those, we have a number of restrictions to cut down on the number of possibilities in what we call a logic. First predicate logic. In predicate logic, there are only constants, right? So somebody has a given age, right? It's a constant. So a Boolean predicate is sort of like a function that evaluates the true or false. It's like a fact or a rule. Then there is first order logic, in which we have variables. So for each thing, it should be that, or there exists some element in a set such that. In second order logic, we have sets where can reason for all items in a set, it should be that something includes something else or excludes something else. Inclusion and exclusion from sets. We have type logics, which is more or less like having objects in a logic. Right? So a human is something bigger than an animal. Right? And for all animals, it should be the predicate X. That means that for all human, it should hold as well because of a transitive relation. Right? Those are some logics. And when we extend that towards programming languages, all of these logics, right, then logic programming is a little bit towards having a declarative programming languages. In a declarative programming language, you say what you want to solve and not how you want to solve it. Right? In imperative languages, it's the other way around. You say how you want to solve it, and then as a byproduct, the solution comes out. In declarative languages, I state what I want, but not how to get there. So the recipe of how to solve a solution, that is basically down to search. So the system should search somehow to find from the given facts a solution. So now we have a searching problem. How do we specify a given search, right? That's an open problem. And how to specify search strategies, search bias, that's open research still. So horn logic, this is basically Prolog. Prolog implements horn logic. So a horn clause is a condition. If it's true, if it's zero, more of its clauses are true. So if somebody is old and wise, then he's happy. Right? If X is the father of Y and Y is the father of Z, then X is the grandfather of Z. Right? Those are rules and there are facts. Right? So somebody is old, somebody is wise. And then from those facts, you can apply these rules to generate more facts. So by inference, you can then infer happy. Right? So there's inference going on. So horn logic is a subset of predicate logic, where predicate logic allows multiple conclusions at the same time, right? So I have a number of facts of which I can apply a number of rules, and in predicate logic, all the solutions would fall out in one step. In horn logic, you get one solution and you have to ask for the next and the next solution. Right? So now the system has to perform a query, right? This is a searching problem. You state a query, please find me the solution given these initial conditions. So the There's also a sort of an if statement, right? So if old and wise, then happy. Right? That if is another kind of if than we had in an imperative language. Here is more of a declarative if statement, where you say, I want to search in this way, and not please execute that if that. Right? So there's also a linear logic. Something is a linear logic if you can only add rules to the set of facts that you already know. You cannot say, and not that. Right? You cannot say the negation of a fact, because the negation of a fact implies that you first have to prove that something does not hold. Proving that something does not hold in prolog is difficult, because there is no not operator in prolog. There's no not. So if you're on the exercises, you have to, there's a small example from where you actually need a not to prove that somebody is the murderer of somebody. Right? To solve such a solution in prolog, you have to both specify the facts that hold and the facts that do not hold. So somebody is the murderer, but you also have to assert the fact that somebody is not the murderer, or does not go to a given class, or did not go to the classroom, or you have to specify all the facts that do not hold true. So you have the complete set of facts that are true and are not true explicit. And then from those you can infer the final solution. Right? So there are ways around linear logic. Right? So prolog implements a step towards linear logic. It also has backtracking logic. So you first assume something to be true until you prove that, until later proof says it cannot be true, and then you take back whatever you had, and then go in a different path in your search strategy. So the idea here is something is still a linear logic if you can take back the whole thing, all of the things that you know that were not true, and go in a different solution. So in general, a Horn clause, it's a searching rule. To prove G0, I have to prove G1, G2 to Gn, right? And all of these commas are ands. I have to prove G1 and G2 and G3 and so on. So it's a comma should be read as and, right? The dot should be say end of our list of rules. And this sign should not be read as an if, but more as a set inclusion almost, right? So it's like an inference. So predicates. So a predicate is a Horn clause with one or more, with zero arguments, right? Then it's a fact. Otherwise, it's a rule if you specify your inclusion. This could also be read as for all x, happy x, old x, and wise x. So this for all operator, that was you can see that from the first slide, what kind of logic that was. So a Horn program can then be queried to find out if given facts hold. But if you start your prolog interpreter, you'll start up with a question mark prompt, and then you can type your queries and specify your rules. So this, if you specify it with a constant, it's something that's unbound, so we don't know what it is, then it's a fact. So happy, Charlie is happy, that's a fact. If you specify it with an X or a Y, and X and Y are not bound yet, it's not known what kind of thing that X is, then it's an existential query, right? You want to show us, see is there something? Is there an X where this holds? Okay, a little example. Right? Happy Charlie, that asserts a fact. Then we can also show happy X. X is happy when X is old and X is wise. And then more rules for saying when you are happy. So there are multiple ways of proving that something is happy. So it's by definition ambiguous, right? Because searching in something that is not ambiguous is trivial. You need ambiguity to provide a search space, right? Ambiguity spans a search space. So rich Charlie, happy Charlie can ask that as queries, and it'll go search for solutions. Especially a searching problem. Search applies recursively as well, right? So I don't have to specify the order of the statements. The order of statements is regardless. But Prolog, however, does is search from top to bottom. So let's try the first rule, see if it can apply, and then if it can't apply it, it'll backtrack and go to the next search rule. We can have ambiguity for subcalls too, right? So we don't know if what rule to apply for wise or for old, right? It's ambiguous. So we need to search until all the subcalls are facts, and then we've proven the head of the search rule. The search order is non-deterministic, although in Prolog it is deterministic, but in Horn logic it is non-deterministic. But the implementation of Horn logic in Prolog is deterministic. It searches from top to bottom. There are parallel Prologs, right? Where the Prolog interpreter is itself parallel. So it's a parallel Prolog. And then they take the non-deterministic approach and try to solve all the possibilities at once in parallel. So to get some performance speed up. So there's also a problem of completeness of search, right? If you have a search engine, will it guarantee that search engine will find you the solution? In Prolog, it's not true. In Prolog, you can write infinite queries, right? Because Prolog goes to the first rule that matches, and if that first rule that matches requires the proof of a subcall, which is also recursively on itself, then it'll search and search and search recursively by applying unification. So Prolog does not have completeness of search. So Prolog does not guarantee that the solution will be found if there is a solution. Other programming search environments will guarantee you a solution. It'll perform, for example, a breadth first search. Prolog does a depth first search towards a solution. The question of closed world versus open world. Closed world means I start with a given set of rules and facts, and that rule and that set cannot be extended while the program is running. I cannot add more rules while the thing is running. Prolog does not have a closed world assumption. In Prolog, you can extend the program while it is running. So while a Prolog program is running, you can add more facts by loading them from disk and start interpreting them as well. So while the program is running, more things can be added. That's like if you have eval in Lisp, for example. Right. So all of these unbound variables, these X's and Y's, are called logical variables then instead of variables if you have in imperative languages. So X is a logical variable. And it's say that it's unbound, and it will be bound once you've instantiated the rule via unification. So whenever you see a rule, conceptually a copy is made of the rule, then the variables in that rule are unified with whatever constants it can be matched to for the subcalls. And whenever the complete rule is matched, right, then the head is proven true. Right? It's also completely untyped, right? We don't say anything about type. We don't say anything that this is an int, this is a symbol. It's all type-free, right? So a head and a goal must match. Can be matched if all of the subcalls are matched by unification of logical variables to constants. Some more examples. So co-author. X and Y are co-authors if X authors book and Y also authors the same book. What happens here is that author X and book will be searched, so author will be matched, so X will be matched to or unified to bound to Ullman, book will be bound to database book, and then book will already be bound to database book, so it will search database book, comma Y. So match Y, Ullman, this matches. X and Y matches, so Y will be matched to Ullman as well, because we've not stated that X would be unequal to Y. So we found one solution. So backtrack, deliver one solution, go for the next solution. X will be bound to Ullman and database book, and Y will be bound to AO. That doesn't work, right? Because database book is unequal AWK book. So they'll continue searching for a Y comma book where book is a database book, and that never happens. So they'll backtrack again, match author X book with AO and AWK book, and AWK book matches this book, so book and book are equal, and then Y will be matched to Kernighan. So that matches, and that is continues on until there are no more solutions. And in the Prolog interpreter, you first type query co-author X, Y, enter, or dot enter. And it'll find the first solution, and you type the same query again, and it'll continue delivering the next and the next and the next answer. So I have to type enter, enter, enter all the time to get to the next and the next and the next answer. Right? So Horn clauses, in effect, specify relations between the arguments and the subcalls, right? It's not a complete relation, but it's a form of relation between the given subcall arguments, right? So facts are, in fact, can also be interpreted as tuples, right? As we've seen them in other programming languages. So person John 35 is a fugitive, right? But also lists. List is also a form of a data structure that works in Prolog that you can be matched to. For example, international access code, and then passes the list of unbound variables and facts. Right, so then in X will be matched. If you then perform a query with a list with code is ununified and London is a fact, then code will be matched to 40, unified with 44, so 44 will be unified with code. Then London will be unified to X, so it's a one will be variable will be matched or unified downward, and the other will be unified upward, right? So that will be unified with that, and that will be unified with that, so it's crossed. Then London is X, and it's all searched for a fact where in UK is London. So that is very tricky, right? Unification works both ways. It does not work just from query to rule, but it also works from rule back to query. So variables can be bound in different ways. So these lists that you have in Prolog are just about the same as you have them in Haskell or in Lisp, right? Where there's a head and the rest of the list, the head and the tail. So to perform an equality test, most of the time in Prolog, there's a coding convention that the last argument is the output, and the other arguments are the input variables. So this is the output, this is the result. If you then call equal with something, right? It will unify both of the arguments via, it will try to unify both of the arguments with these facts, and I'll see if it will match. Right, so for example, if I have equal empty list, it'll match to true. So whenever I say equal A comma A comma B, A comma B comma C, then and A and B are empty lists, then C will be unified with true. So there's no assignment, right? It's all via output variables, via assignment, via unification. So unification can be interpreted as both output parameters and input parameters. Right. So for example, how do we implement append? How do we append something to a list in Prolog? So we'll take the last argument as the output, and these are the input lists, other input lists, and that should be the result. So to append an empty list to a list, we'll deliver the empty list. If we invoke append with three arguments, right? Then it will first bind the, so if you call, append A, B, C. Where we know that A is empty list. B is a list with 1, 2, 1, 3. So. What will happen to C? Well, C is the output variable, so it should be unbound. It should not be unified yet, right? So C is forced by this rule to be unified with the second argument. So then C will be bound or unified with the second argument list. Right, so it's a little trickier than just output variables or output parameters. The same happens with concatenation, right? So to append a list with a head and a rest with another list, the output output list should be the head X with the rest, where the rest is defined as L1 plus L2. It is very tricky, right? You have to be very careful with what you unify with what. One problem in declarative languages based on search is if you have a very large search space, then it will take you a long time to run your program, of course. Right, so we need some way to make Prolog programs more efficient. We need to have some way for the programmer to influence how to search, and what to search first and what to search last. So we need a way to fix the search order. What Prolog at least is doing is top to bottom search textually. So if you write a Prolog program, you should write the simple things first and then the complex things last. And hopefully the simple things will be matched and the program will be fast. What in Prolog can happen is infinite recursion. For example, x1 will be is implied by x1. Then you call x2. And what happens here? First of all, try to find an effect. It doesn't happen. In here, x1 will be matched. It will search for x1 for a rule that matches. It matches, and it will go into an infinite recursion. It's not nice. So in Prolog, you can write infinite loops. There are some tools to find infinite loops in Prolog programs, so a little bit of compiler analysis. There's also the abort operator, right? So, or the cut operator, it's called. So the cut operator, an exclamation mark, that says, if you've already proven that G1, G2, and G3 hold, you don't have to go back with backtracking over G1, G3, G1, G2, G3. You already know that these three horn clauses already hold. You don't have to try and do them again. So if G5 or G4 fails, it'll fail the whole rule if you've already proven the first three. So it's a way of limiting the search space. It's useful for when you have mutually exclusive conditions. Right, so H, smaller than 18, bigger than 18, but smaller than 65 or larger than 65 are all mutually exclusive conditions. So all of them exclude the others. And you do not need to go, if you have proven that you are smaller than 18, you don't have to try all of the others, right? So that's the idea here. Mutual exclusive conditions, so you don't go back over mutual exclusive conditions. So the efficiency, is a Prolog program fast compared to a C program or a C++ program? Of course not. C++ will always beat Prolog. Why? Because there's an explicit recipe going on where the programmer has coded a lot of what is known explicitly in his program, while Prolog will be searching all the time. Right? It will try things that don't really make sense, because it will try the whole search space. Another problem with Prolog is that you can't specify loops. You don't have true recursion, so there are a number of coding patterns that we know are very efficient that you cannot express in Prolog. There are Prolog compilers that try to compile Prolog down to C code. So Prolog to C compilers. The code that comes out of Prolog to C compilers is not very good. So it's still not very good, but it's if you're trying to prototype a bit of code, if you have some sort of idea in your head that matches logic, then Prolog is a good idea for a little bit of prototyping before you start implementing it in low level in C++. Summing. How do I perform arithmetic in Prolog? Prolog is not just about proving things, it's also about computing. So how do I compute in Prolog? So if I want to compute the sum of all numbers, right? So sum from 0 to n of I. How do I compute that? Well, the sum of only 1 is 1, right? Otherwise it's n, and n is n2 is n minus 1, where I then have to perform a recursive search for the sub-answer, the smaller answer. So there's a bit of recursion going on. But it's very strange that you have to write an S0 here, right? I do a recursive invocation where S0 will be the sub-answer of the recursive step. So the S0 will be unified as like an output parameter of the sub-result. And then that sub-result will be assigned, giving S, and that is our return value. Right. So it's a little tricky with unification, but it works. So the idea for arithmetic is to use output parameters as you do use them in normal programming languages. Sorting, how do we sort with something like Prolog? Idea is just like in functional programming languages to create copies of things, so to have lists that are effectively read-only. If you want to create a new, want to add something to a list, you create a copy of the list, append the new element, and then create a new list and return the new list. So list manipulation is via copying, as you would in functional programming languages. So, for example, quicksort. Element, and find everything that is smaller than that element, and patch that to the left, and from the input take everything that is bigger than the pivot, and add that to the right. So you search everything that is bigger than some random element, add everything that is smaller to the left, and add everything bigger to the right. So we take a pivot, and have a sorted output array. And we take the pivot just to take the first element of this unsorted input. Take the pivot and we split the array in a tail and something that is smaller or equal and put it in the larger. So we have a split function that splits a list in everything bigger and everything smaller. That's the job of our split function. And then we have an append to append everything that is smaller than the pivot to the left and everything bigger to the right. Right, so the split function was for finding sublists of everything bigger or everything smaller. Right, so if I create a list with everything smaller, I need to have an element is either smaller or it is bigger. So it's a mutually exclusive condition, so I can apply the cut operator. So there's the exclamation mark there. If that rule applies, then I don't need to try that rule. Once I know that it's smaller, I have something that I need to that I should append to the smaller list. Otherwise, I know that it's bigger than the pivot, and I need to apply it to the larger list. So I have a smaller output list and a bigger output list, and I have to append to either one or the other. Where Prolog really shines is if you have a searching problem. Then if you have a searching problem, then the program matches very well to the idea of Prolog, which is search itself. So if you have a problem where you need to apply search, then having a programming language where search is a primitive in the language, then it's easy to specify what your problem is and let it search for the answer automatically. So if, for example, in graphs, I need to find a path from one element to another element. I can very concisely specify how to search in such a graph. Right? I specify the edges, those are facts of my graph. And then I can specify paths in my graph fairly concisely. A path is either if there's a direct edge or there is an edge from S to some other element and then from that other element to the destination. So it will search via two statements a path in my graph. This is also how you do parsing. The parsing in Prolog, you can write very concise parsers in Prolog by searching all possible orders of parse trees to find a parse tree that matches my input. You can also dynamically read facts and rules from files. So I can start my Prolog interpreter and read new files on the fly and execute them into the running program. So assert happy Ronald means read something from file and assert it, make it true, make it a new fact. Or assert happy X has candy X, and I assert a new rule on the fly. Data log. There are a number of problems with Prolog. Most of all, it's efficiency. But another is I only get one answer at a time. In data log, the idea is to get all the answers at one go. Right? Let the program search all the answers, do it however he wants to, until there are no more answers to be delivered. That's called a fixed point is reached. Right? There's nothing new being generated anymore. And then I have a set of final answers and I return that final set as a return value. The consequence of fixed point computation is that I cannot allow any complex rules. I cannot have any nesting of functions, for example. FA is true when G from A, H from A is true, right? So, because that would explode the search space so much that automatic search for all the answers wouldn't work anymore. Datalog also adds negation most of the time. So somebody is somebody's barber if he shaves that man but does not shave himself. So multi-paradigm logics. We've looked at Prolog, right? Can we add stuff to Prolog to make it more useful? Right? Programming Prolog does not allow me to write a GUI. I cannot, by induction, search for the button to click. It doesn't work. It doesn't make sense in your head even, right? So how do I add stuff to Prolog to make it more useful? How do I add concurrency? How do I add GUIs? How do I add file I/O in a more natural way? So how do we add stuff to Prolog? OZ is one of those languages where they try to integrate Prolog with other stuff. So like Prolog, OZ has unification for variables. So when you see a statement like X equals sign 3, it doesn't mean assign 3 to the memory location X. It means X is unified with the constant 3. If you then later say X is 4, then it's an error, because X is already unified with 3, and 3 is not equal to 4. Right? So there's unification going on. There's no memory locations that you write to. Right? There's also a nice browser where you can see what the values of things are. So you can say browse X, and it'll give you a browser, it'll show you X and 3. Right? There's local scopes, so you can have multiple variables inside of a scope. So local X, so with local you create this new scope for declaring new variables. And with this browse X, Y, Z, you have a browse the list of X, Y, Z. If X, Y, or Z isn't unified yet, it'll show you the X. Otherwise, it'll show you the constant, right? If it's already unified with something. So here it'll say, it'll open a window with 4. Right? There are also objects in OZ, but the fields of an object are again unifiable variables. They are not memory locations, the fields. But let's say here, I declare a number of local variables, and I say T is a tree with a key and a value and a left and a right. Right? And then L is some symbol, Y is some constant, and nil some other constants. Nil is no normal, isn't a normal variable. It's like a symbol. And then I can browse my tree, and I'll see tree, key is self, left nil, and so on. This is as you'd expect it. Right. So okay, now we now have unified, a unified model with both unification and objects and local variables. Right. Now what is the meaning of some code like this? Right. I declare x, y, z. X is then a function call with arguments c and a. What happens here is it'll first perform a form of lazy evaluation. It'll first ignore. I need to evaluate that because all the arguments are known. X is unified with FCA, and now I have to evaluate, I really do some work, invoke this function. I have to evaluate F, invoke this function, and then there's an equality or an inequality, and it'll be an error or no error. So the equal sign was a comparison, right? So with an equal sign, we unified unbound to bound variables, right? If you say x is 3, then 3 is unified with x, or x becomes 3. With an equal, we block the thread until another thread has unified it. So now we have concurrent execution. So we have a number of global variables that are initially unbound. One thread says print x. Yeah, x is unbound, so it's no fun. And another thread then later does a unification on this bound variable, on this unbound variable, making it bound, and that unblocks the other thread. Right. So if one thread does, if two threads. One thread does print x equals 1. And some other thread, sometime later, it says x equals 1. Right, so this thread will be blocked until the other thread performs the unification. So there is implicit synchronization. You do not have to write wait, notify, or signal or send message as you would have, or synchronized in what you would have in Java. This is all implicit. All the synchronization between threads is completely hidden. Right. So unlike prolog, we also have instruction scheduling. So one instruction is executed after the next instruction and the next and the next. There's also if statements, so real if statements, not the logical version of that. So you can say unify x, unify y, and then compare the result, and then perform a condition for unifying something or something else. That makes OS more general than we have in prolog. Also objects, right? So you can extract a specific field from an object. Again, these fields are initialized by unification, right? So if you first declare a class or an instantiated, all of its fields will be initially unbound, ununified, until you perform an assignment, a unification to these fields, and then they have a value. A little more complex. There's also pattern matching. Let's say I create a tree object, right? And I want to find all the leaves in my tree. Then I need to perform, what I want to do is traverse over my tree data structure. And once I found a leaf in my tree, then do something. So I now need to compare, is this tree of objects a leaf? And that is via pattern matching. And so first I create a local variable tree with a number of unbound variables, and then given a tree in. And tree in is my argument here. So tree in will be matched. Its components will be extracted via pattern matching. So K1, V1, T1, T2 will receive their values via unification. Right, so pattern matching here means given a abstract variable, pull its elements out of it, and given the unify the components of those of fields. Right. Similarly, there's a case statement for doing this pattern matching a little more explicitly. Before it was a little implicit. Here it's really explicit. But you say case given a expression, see if it's of this pattern or that pattern or that pattern. So a real case statement, so you can do pattern matching, like you'd know it in Java, for example. Right. Here's another example. Also has lists, just as Prolog has lists. So here I unify X with a list of 1, 2, 3, and then I perform a case statement for pattern matching 1, 2, 3 against. Now, is it 1? No. Then it will continue on. Is it 2, 3? Is it a case of 2, 3, 1? No. Else, unify Y with 3. And if I execute it with a browse statement, it'll see 3. Okay, how do we use such a case statement in our example? Right? Here we have a case statement for case for 3, and 3 in is our input argument. We don't then do a case statement to find pattern match against all the possible cases. For if it's a null tree, it's no tree at all. Otherwise, it's a case of 3, and then we have pattern matching where 3 in will be analyzed to see if it matches this pattern. And then I'll do unification of the arguments with the extracted components. You don't really have to look at the code, only of this case statement, right? So functions can also be passed as values. So we have function pointers in OZ. For example, and then. And then is a function that takes two arguments as its input, so this will be executed or that will be executed if B is true or false. If B is true, execute that, is false, execute that. So an if statement can be coded with a function pointers. That's the bound. It's a little hard to write, right? So it's a We have some syntactic sugar in OZ to make this a little more concise. For example, here, right? And then it's still there. But now instead of writing B1 as a function, writing the B1 function pointer, I can omit them, writing dollar signs. Concurrency, already talked about a little bit about concurrency. Is this model here, where you wait until something has become unified. It's still a lot of work to program like this. So there are a number of shortcuts to make parallel programming via unification a little easier. So communication is still implicit. You wait until something becomes bound. That is the underlying principle. So here I created a local variable block. Then I create a thread. It'll start running in the background, and the threads will start running this bit of code here, in parallel to this code here. So this runs in parallel to that. So here I'm browsing variables that have not become bound yet, because this runs in parallel to that. These variables will not have received a value yet. And for example, x3 should be made a mistake here. This would be x's here. No, this would be y, x3, for example. If this is x3, this is x3. If x3 is bound, then this statement can continue. Okay. For another example for computing Fibonacci, it's a little simpler. So function Fibonacci with an x, an unbound variable. Then create a thread for invoking Fibonacci in the end. And there's no synchronization here. I don't have to explicitly wait for stuff. I don't have to have semaphores or anything. I just fork my thread. It will run in the background. And once it's done, It'll return the answer and it'll continue. So how do we use, how do we program a client-server or producer-consumer problem? These producer-consumer problems are very, very common in parallel programming. So we have a number of a sort of communication channel in between a thread and another thread, right? How do you program such a communication channel? In general, you use a sort of list, where the producer adds stuff to a list, and the consumer pulls things from that list and processes them. Right? But how do we, if we were to use a generic list, right? Then you have a sort of unidirectional channel, right? Where the list would effectively grow and grow and grow, and it would never get smaller, right? So you have to be a little careful there. Try to program this here. So we have a block where we create a thread that runs the generator in the background, and its result will be added to the sum. The sum function will then be called and pattern match the result of the generator. So the generator generates stuff, and which will be passed to sum for computing the sum of the list. So this creates a list, and this gets elements from the list and sums them, right? So if this generator is finished, it'll return nil, which the sum function will then accept as a stream of data, matched with nil, and then it'll be the end of the list. So those are ways for synchronizing between the producer and the consumer. The producer puts a special element in the list, which the consumer will then see this special element and know that it is finished. This works, but it's not very optimal. So the generator is eager, right? So if I create a list of a billion elements, if I have a billion elements to push through the channel, and a generator is very fast, then it will consume a lot of memory, right? Because the generator will produce, and I have the whole list with a billion elements in memory, and a consumer will generally be slow, right? And then work its way back towards the head of the list. So it will use a lot of memory, and there's a lot of load imbalance, right? So the producer should wait for the consumer to avoid all these unnecessarily large lists, right? So the solution there is to use futures. We'll talk about futures in next week or a week after, when we talk about parallel programming paradigms. So the idea of a future is that you block until the channel that you're blocking on has some value. So future blocks until Y becomes bound via unification. It's like a wrapper around this list that I had before. For example, here I do a send on a port, or another send on a port, which will generate a list with a future at the end. And then the future will become a sort of a terminator function. And inside of these ports, I can then administer how many things were already in this port. So I can avoid this unbounded memory use. This is producer-consumer between two OS tasks. So I can create a thread that then copies things from taken and puts it in given. So this statement here is the communication channel, but is an explicit thread that copies things from one thread and adds it explicitly to another thread via unification. So there are three threads in effect going on here. There's the producer, there's the consumer, and there is this separate thread in the middle that takes things from the producer and hands them to the consumer explicitly. And that is what this simple statement in the middle is doing here. That is the coding of this statement in the middle. So I can avoid this unnecessarily communication, this unnecessarily large memory overhead by adding special syntax. That is what they did in OS. Of course, computers are most efficient not in doing search, but by doing arithmetic, by adding and subtracting and multiplying stuff. That is where a computer is most efficient. So we need to have some way of computing efficiently, and we also need a way of manipulating memory efficiently. That is where Prolog fails, right? Prolog does not allow you to create an object or efficiently manipulate memory. So what they added in OS was to explicitly allocate objects and assign it fields, assign it memory. For example, here I do call a new cell, which allocates memory, so it's like malloc. I allocate memory with an A argument for its initial value. Then I can have an assign a B inside A, assign X inside of A. So I can have explicit memory allocation and explicit memory assignment. It goes away a little bit from the Prolog idea, right? We're stepping away from Prolog and adding a little bit of imperative programming for efficiency. It also adds loops. You do not have loops in Prolog. Why? If you have a loop, you have a loop variable that can take multiple values. In Prolog, that is not possible, right? Because you unify a variable only once. So if you were to have a loop in Prolog, you would have a unification with a loop variable. For e is 0 to 10, e will be bound to 0, but e can never be bound to 1 because it's already bound, right? You cannot take back what you already unified in Prolog. So they added new syntax for loop iteration because you need it for efficiency. So what did we end up with? We now have fields and objects which we can dynamically instantiate. There's a garbage collector, just as you have in Java, for throwing away objects that you no longer need. You can have inheritance between objects. So everything that you had from that we know from objects, we have in OS as well. So now we have object-oriented Prolog, kind of. So we have, for example, here, this is a fairly normal syntax. Some class counter with some attribute, like an int value or something that you would have in Java. You have a methods, a normal methods, an increment method. This at thing is for referencing the values from the old version of the object. Whenever you do perform an assignment of an object, you implicitly create a new instance and manipulate the copy. Right? So all objects are effectively immutable. Right, so you also use classes for code organization. It's like having modules in Pascal, for example. So again, this is fairly familiar, right? And syntax, a class inherits from some other class. A few methods. Well, then you also have this bit of pattern matching there with unification going on. So it's the core of the language is still Prolog-like. Like Java, you then have this implicit self, like this in Java. So you can send messages to instances or messages to the class object. This is what we have in static methods and normal methods, instance methods in Java. So this is again fairly conventional. So methods have default arguments, right? Saw that already. So method inc is, you should usually be, be invoked with one, right? So send the one as a default argument to its argument value for unification. And that's it for today.